2014. I'm Albert Mohler, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. On two issues, two trajectories even, the nation of France is actually far ahead of the United States, at least for now. Those two issues are the secularization of the culture and the disappearance or decline of a marriage culture. At the center of a very recent controversy in France is the president of France, François Hollande. He is no stranger to controversy, but until now, the controversies have had mostly to do with the French economy and very high resistant levels of French unemployment. But now sex is at the center of the controversy, and that's something fairly new, because in France, it's very hard to scandalize the French people when it comes to matters of public leadership and sexuality. But François Hollande appears to have achieved what previous French presidents could only have aspired to, and that is to have created a controversy over his sex life, what appears to be a genuine controversy. As New York Times reporters Alyssa Rubin and Scott Sayeri report, quote, "The photographs show a stout man of middling height striding out of an ordinary-looking Parisian apartment house, a helmet and a dark visor obscuring his face. He gets on a motorized scooter and zooms away," end quote. Well, this would not be much of a controversy in France, but for the fact that it was revealed that the man behind the helmet and the mask was none other than the French president. And what he was up to was what is delicately called a romantic liaison in France. It turns out that the French president was meeting with an actress 18 years his junior. And as the New York Times also comments, quote, "Revelations of that sort typically do not shock the French people, and this one is no different. But Mr. Hollande, while not denying the report, lashed out at the magazine for violating what he has sought to define as his privacy rights, suggesting that the French president, like any citizen, is entitled to assignations," end quote. The magazine in this case is the periodical in France that broke the story. And President Hollande's current tactic seems to be to blame the magazine for invading his privacy, rather than bearing any embarrassment for being caught in a sex scandal. At this point, we can learn a great deal from the situation in France. President Hollande is not the first French president to have a scandalous sex life. The late French president François Mitterrand had a mistress that was so unhidden that she, with her daughter, their daughter, appeared at the official state funeral for François Mitterrand, along with his widow and other members of his family. President Hollande's predecessor in office, President Nicolas Sarkozy, found himself in at least some controversy for divorcing his wife. But before divorcing his wife, he had a younger woman move into the presidential palace with him, and that created at least a bit of a scandal. But the situation with President Hollande is altogether different, or perhaps it's just the next step in their trajectory. President Hollande has actually never been married. He had an affair with a woman with whom he lived and had two children. She is not the woman now identified as the First Lady of France. The lady identified as the First Lady is the live-in, the partner that François Hollande has had for a number of years. That woman, Valerie Trierweiler, has found herself now in a hospital, an undisclosed hospital in Paris, where she is being treated for shock after the revelations of the affair that President Hollande has now had with the actress 18 years his junior. So France, over the last several months, has had a first lady, a woman recognized to be the first lady of the nation, isn't married to the president, but lives with him. His children, mothered by a different woman, do not live with him. And now the big question is, will this actress with whom he has had the affair become the new first lady of France, also unmarried to the president? If you're following all the complexities, you're probably ahead of the French people, who appear to be befuddled at the president's clumsiness in dealing with his own sex life. But of course, what we're looking at here as Christians is something far deeper. We have to ask the question, how can a society have reached this point? There have been people in power who have had sexual affairs throughout all of human history. Sex has been an undercurrent of politics and of power ever since Genesis 3. And yet, when we look at this, we recognize that what France now represents is a nation so utterly secularized that it bears no Christian conscience on issues of personal sexuality. The nation has done its very best to separate a public life from personal sexual morality. Indeed, the nation has been working hard to make sexual morality a non-moral issue, at least in terms of basic consensual adult relationships. You also have a situation in which marriage has been so marginalized that an unmarried president with a live-in as First Lady is not that controversial in France. But what we also need to note here from a Christian worldview is that this kind of attempted separation of personal character and public face and sexual morality simply has limits. It doesn't work. It doesn't work even in France. And the current controversy in France points this out emphatically. The French people seem to have lost the moral vocabulary to know even how to describe the wrongness of what President Hollande has done and is doing. They have already crossed so many moral bridges that it's very hard to go back and figure out how exactly to define the wrongdoing of their president. And yet, it appears that a good number of the French people, if not a majority, believe that what he has done is wrong. But of course, the loss of a moral conscience and the absolute moral confusion of the situation means that the French people, and the French media as their representative in this case, are in a very difficult position to try to figure out how to define exactly what is wrong. Lacking a notion of sin and any kind of fixed notion of sexual morality, the French people, having distanced themselves from a Christian conscience and from the culture of marriage, now find themselves, not unexpectedly, in deep moral confusion. As I said at the beginning, France is ahead of the United States in terms of the trajectory of secularization and the death of the marriage culture. But in this case, you just have to wonder, when we look at this controversy in France, are we looking at our future? If those two trajectories continue in this country, as they have for the last several years, it's hard to argue that what we see in France is not what we are soon to see in our own headlines. Shifting to the issue of evolution, a recent opinion piece published in USA Today claims in its headline, "Evolution is not a matter of belief." The subtitle, "Who says we have to choose between God and science?" Well, just look at the headline. Arguing that evolution is not a matter of belief is absolutely absurd. But what the newspaper, if not the columnist, is trying to insinuate is that evolution is actually settled fact. It doesn't take any kind of actual active believing to accept the theory of evolution. And then the subtitle seems to also argue that there needs to be no choice between God and science. And from the Christian worldview perspective, that is certainly true. Reality, rightly understood, will be found to be absolutely consonant with the Bible. The Christian worldview doesn't believe in various or plural arenas of truth, in different forms of truth. Truth is truth, and all truth is God's truth. And we also believe, as Christians, that when the Christian worldview is fully consonant with Scripture, it will also be fully consistent with true science, with true reality. But what's found in this article by Tom Krautenmacher is the argument that science is simply some kind of objective way of knowing, that it doesn't involve its own form of faith, and that it is not a social construct. But of course it is. And in this case, we have to make very clear that to operate by the Christian worldview means that we do have to make very hard choices when it comes to choosing between belief in the Scripture and belief in worldviews that argue that the Scripture is either irrelevant or flat wrong. Krautenmacher writes, and I quote, "In a time of great divides over religion and politics, it's not surprising that we treat evolution the way we do political issues. But here's the problem. As settled science, evolution is not a matter of opinion, or something one chooses to believe in or not, like a religious proposition. And by often framing the matter this way, we involved in the news media, internet debates, and everyday conversation do a disservice to science, religion, and our prospects for having a scientifically literate country." End quote. Before going further, let's consider just a few of the statements. First of all, we have the phrase, settled science. What exactly is that? Science is actually never settled. Where would we settle science? Back in the 17th century? The 18th? The 19th? 1955? 1995? 2005? 2014? Science is never settled. At any given time, there may be a scientific consensus, but it shows a gross misunderstanding of science to claim that science is ever finally settled. Then he also suggests that scientific knowledge is somehow greatly different than what he calls religious knowledge or belief in religious propositions. In other words, he says that no particular form of belief is necessary with science, but let's think about that for just a moment. Every worldview is based upon certain presuppositions, and the scientific worldview is no different. And those presuppositions lead to several entailments that are absolutely necessary given the presuppositions. Science operates in exactly the same way. If you accept the naturalistic presuppositions of naturalistic science, you will come up with naturalistic understandings, and you can even call that settled science. But that doesn't settle the matter, either scientifically nor philosophically, or even for that matter, of course, theologically. As you might expect, Mr. Krautenmacher goes on to bemoan the fact that so many Americans disbelieve in evolution, or do not believe in evolution. He cites the fact that so many white evangelicals reject evolution, and so many Republicans, as has been documented in recent research. But he also has to acknowledge that a very sizable percentage of Democrats and other Americans don't accept the theory of evolution. And this, he explains, is an embarrassment. Later in his article, he writes this: for starters, belief means something different in a religion conversation than it means when we're talking about science. In the case of faith, he writes, it usually means accepting the moral and spiritual truth of something and giving it your trust and devotion. In talking about evolution, it is more precise to call it scientifically valid or an accurate account of what we observe. No leaps of faith or life-altering commitments required, end quote. But anyone who actually looks at the theory of evolution has to understand that a great deal of faith, a great deal of belief, is actually implicated and required. No one has observed evolution at work. It's a theory of how life developed. And furthermore, there are gaps in evolutionary theory, well-known and accepted gaps. One has to accept on faith that what happened in those gaps is actually what amounts to the entirety of the theory in terms of consistency. Furthermore, the entire theory of evolution is based upon a presupposition known as uniformitarianism. That is the very basic belief or theory, the assumption taken on faith, that time and progress have always been exactly what they are now. That the natural processes we observe now had to be uniform over time, such that there could not be some kind of interruption in the process that would explain the developments we now see in various forms of life. But there is no way to prove uniformitarianism, of course. It is, contrary to what you read in this article, taken on faith. It is a presumption, a presupposition. Krautenmacher goes on to argue that evolution actually has nothing to do with God whatsoever. He says, a scientific concept backed by an overwhelming amount of supporting evidence, evolution describes a process by which species change over time. It hazards no speculations about the origins of that process, end quote. But that's just flatly false. Evolutionists, leading evolutionists, some of the best-known evolutionists in the world, the leading purveyors of the theory in the popular culture, do indeed speculate, indeed they do more than speculate, about what is behind the process, or as he says, about the origins of that process. As a matter of fact, for evolution to be a part of a naturalistic worldview, it has to explain what's behind the process. Otherwise, it simply operates in a box, and that box is anathema to the very scientists who are pushing evolution. Then comes this paragraph, quote, third, as a good number of Christians in this country understand, it is more than possible to accept the validity of evolution and believe in God's role in creation at the same time. Even among theologically conservative Christians, he writes, we see an evolution in the understanding of faith and science. Divine evolution, anyone? It's a concept that is catching on as more evangelicals come to see evolution as God's way of orchestrating an ongoing process of creation, end quote. Well, he's certainly accurate in arguing that a good number of Christians want to argue that you can have a divine role in creation and the theory of evolution. It's certainly true that you can have some kind of theory of evolution and hold to God's involvement or supervision of the process. That's called theistic evolution. It's also completely out of bounds in the scientific world. As a matter of fact, in terms of the dominant scientific establishment, theistic evolution holds little more credibility than creationism. Why? It's because evolutionary theory is based upon an almost purely naturalistic worldview. And almost here is almost unnecessary. It is almost an absolutely unconditionally naturalistic worldview. There's more to the article, of course, but it doesn't get any better. What we have here is an example of the kind of misinformation that the author seems to bemoan and to criticize. What we have here is also a false premise that leads to a false promise. The false premise is that science is one form of knowledge, and that theology and religious knowledge are a different form of knowledge. The late Harvard paleontologist Stephen Jay Gould even went so far as to argue about what he called non-overlapping magisteria. That scientific jargon for arguing that religion and science are dealing with two fundamentally different and never overlapping authorities and fields of knowledge. But both the dominant scientific establishment and the evangelical community must come to terms with the fact that these supposedly non-overlapping magisteria actually do overlap, and they overlap a great deal, and they overlap from both sides and from both directions. Nevertheless, in its own way, this article proves the point entirely. the confusion over evolution and the confusion over evolution and religious faith, and specifically the confusion over evolution and Christianity, is so widespread it's found even in the article that seeks to correct it. Finally, in terms of signs of the times, a very interesting article from South Korea. Naray Kim and Michelle Kim, reporting for Reuters, tell us that babies of 1 year on their first birthday in South Korea are now experiencing huge birthday parties, and the reason why is very telling. As the reporters describe, it takes a lot more than a cake and a song to celebrate a baby's first birthday in South Korea, where in the past, disease and starvation claimed so many lives that the completion of an infant's first year was a major milestone. The first birthday is an event at which affluent parents in one of the world's richest countries flaunt wealth, connections, and even their offspring's gilded career prospects at lavish parties, end quote. After the Second World War and throughout the experience of the Korean conflict, children in South Korea did face mass starvation, and the fact that an infant reached the age of one was a very significant and celebrated milestone. But those days of starvation are long in the past. Korea, South Korea, is now one of the world's most advanced economies. And what is being flaunted in this case, in these celebrations, is not release from poverty and want, but rather ostentatious wealth. But as I told you, there's more to the story, and the reporters get right to the point. Quote, although starvation is no longer a threat, children have become precious commodities in another sense. As fewer South Koreans marry and more women pursue careers, the birth rate in this Asian country has plummeted. The average number of babies born per woman fell to 1.23 in 2010 from 4.53 just in 1970. Quote, people these days attach a greater meaning to the birth date because they do not give birth to a lot of children. That was just one Korean mother's explanation of the phenomenon. Of course, plummeting birth rates are not unique to South Korea. In China, where the nation's draconian one-child policy has been in effect since the 1970s, often the only child, in many cases a boy by sex preference, often by infanticide or abortion, the little boy is often known as a little emperor, simply because all of the parents' hopes and dreams and aspirations, and perhaps even peer pressure and self-esteem, are forced upon this one child. In other words, a little emperor. These lavish birthday parties in South Korea are just a manifestation of the same kind of trend. And what we're looking at here is, of course, what happens when you have a world in which you have a plummeting birth rate. The children who are then born become something like personal projects for parents. And if you really want to know what that looks like, you probably don't have to go to either China or South Korea. In your own neighborhood, there are probably plenty of children who really operate as the personal projects of their parents. And that's simply not healthy. And from the Christian worldview, we should understand why it's not healthy in any culture, wherever it's found. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'm speaking to you from West Palm Beach, Florida, and I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.